brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a two-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible. Financial geniuses. Monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it. So your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who pieced together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Travis Decker is who we're going to be talking about today, and we're going to be breaking down what on earth was going on with this man leading up to and after the alleged murder of his three daughters, Olivia, Evelyn, and Peyton, when he was having his custody visit because he had some goo that came out of him at one point in life. He must be able to see these children on the weekend. What could possibly be more unhealthy if they're not hanging out with the PTSD borderline who's living out of the truck? That sounds like a great place for kids. Joining me to discuss, Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author. Nightbird is the new book. The copy I have is up in my room because that's where I was reading it. I got to bring it back down here, but it's available wherever books are sold. Nightbird. Okay. So this is one of those situations where it is a custody dispute. Mom and dad are separated here. I think they're divorced. Yeah, they're divorced. Ex-wife name is Whitney, so we'll be talking about her. Divorced with court-ordered custody agreements and arrangements. And it's set up where he can't have them overnights anymore because he's already proven that he's not so good at that. Took them to some sort of a veterans place and had the girls sleeping there amongst like 20 some other men who are essentially homeless. Not a great place for little kids, but the court still said you get your weekend visits. The hoops that you have to jump through, I guess, sometimes to get a judge to say you shouldn't be around the kids. Let's start there. What's going on here?
We have a broken system. Sometimes you find judges who do a good job, who do put the safety of the children first. But then you find judges who seem to be utterly clueless and come up with these plans. I mean, at the very least, this guy, if they decided he needed contact with the kids, which I think you and I would agree he didn't, it wasn't in their best interest, at least have supervised visits where you have a person who is present and monitoring every bit of interaction that goes on. And, you know, that would have been at bare minimum. But yeah, this was an atrocity. It was happening here in the Pacific Northwest near where I live, and I was in tears about it. It was just shocking.
It's heartbreaking. I have a little girl, and I have a stepdaughter too. And you see these little kids in these pictures, and it takes you back to when they're little, and it just, that was my worst fear, back then. Mine was pretty little at the time when I went through a divorce, also had someone who was diagnosed with BPD, and it was scary as hell. Eventually when I did allow that for a short period of time, eventually she moved away. And that I think honestly for the better rather than this sort of thing happening. But when you have someone like this who insists on seeing the kids, has all of these health problems, as a parent, you're relying on that system to do its job, to protect your kids, to protect you. But quite often they do not, because there is this preset, if you will, in our system of, it's always best to have the paternal or the maternal parents there, seemingly no matter what. This has been, we've talked about this before, but let's just kind of start again for people who haven't heard it. Why do we have this in our system? Why do they believe that this is always the best route, when clearly we've shown for decades that it is not the best route to have the blood relative there? And it seems to be the trump card over everything else.
Yeah. We have got a mess in the legal system, and there's a lot of conflicting opinion about it. I wrote the name of the law down. In 1980, the Adoption Assistance and Child Welfare Act was established as a federal law to prioritize family reunification. And so family reunification became the default for what is considered the ideal goal in every circumstance. And this is a law based upon data from the 70s that highlighted all the problems that kids had that were in foster care. And as you and I have discussed, there can be tremendous problems with finding adequate foster care for kids.
Yeah.
However, this data, many believe this data is flawed and misinterpreted. And this idea that the default should always be number one priority is reunification, a lot of us disagree with that. And the problem is, once you have something established legally and in the system, it's very hard to change it. And I think that's where we need to be looking. There is an organization run by a woman who contacted me after you and I discussed this about a year ago,
oh, really?
This topic.
Yeah,
childwelfaremonitoring.org. And this is a blog run by a former social worker named Marie Cohen. And I think for anybody who wants more information about it, that would be a good resource to do some reading.
I have to look that up, childwelfaremonitoring.org. Mm-hmm. In the mental health community, in the psychological community, in the psychology community, where does this stand overall? Because we have the law, the legal world, which takes forever to get anything through or changed once it's there. And we have the medical community over here. I'm just talking about the medical, not the legal side. Mm-hmm. Overall, I mean, is there a stance that is held on this as a whole, where is family reunification still the gold standard? Is it still the thing that most people lean to, saying this is the best, or has that changed dramatically in that community? Or is it 50-50? How does it stand?
You know, I don't know of any organized statement that's been put out by any organization about it. I think most clinicians feel the way I do, that we have a mess. Mm-hmm. We have a mess. And very often the courts do the wrong thing. And then we get into the difficulty with, yes, there are problems with kids in foster care, and we don't have enough foster care. We don't certainly have enough quality foster care, and how to change that. I think we all get sort of stuck on, you know, the nightmare that is the child custody mess.
I feel like we have more stories here about people who have the right to be with their children doing horrible things to them versus people who do not have the right to be near these kids. It seems like, I mean, the system seems to be working as designed right now. I mean, it's very broken in its results, mm-hmm. but the system itself is functioning as designed, which the design is the problem here, is that needs to be adjusted. How does something like this get fixed or changed? I mean, in the legal side over here, are the courts following a directive or some sort of a statute of some sort of family reunification is always the goal no matter what? Yeah. Or is this really up to each individual judge depending on what they believe? Or does every jurisdiction have to go family reunification first and always if that's a possibility?
I think that family reunification first is the legal standard right now, that when it's possible to do that. But there are judgment calls. And I think often, you know, one of the horrors, I think we saw this in the Harmony Montgomery case, is that they try to reunify, and then there has to be a failure of the reunification. So the child has to be in danger or abused again. And how many times do we put them through this attempt at reunification? It's almost also, I think, this romanticization of parental bonds and that parents are uniquely equipped to love their children, which is absurd. Yeah. So I think some judges are certainly more savvy and others less so and just follow, you know, the most concrete guidelines about if parents jump through the hoops and go to the parenting classes and, you know.
But they don't.
I mean, they don't. They don't. And even when they do, I don't see little kids anymore, but I used to see a lot of little kids, and I would get these cases where they were trying to reunify them. And yeah, the parents would go to parenting classes, and they would learn to spout the verbiage that they were supposed to spout. I would discipline my child with positive love and always support their self-esteem. And they were just parroting. They didn't have a clue what that meant. But they had gone to the class, they checked the box, and okay, you did it, you know? And some of this, as we've also talked about in the past, child welfare is horrendously, as far as protective services, underfunded, understaffed. They burn the people out because they see these cases that are just atrocious and they can't do anything or they can't do enough. And I have seen a lot of child welfare workers come to therapy with PTSD because they just couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah. And then you have these people who live this kind of a life, if they survive it as a child. And quite often, I would imagine there's a repeat of the cycle in ways, shapes, and forms because they get so damaged by the system that is damaged itself. And the cycle, continues. This is someone who was supposed to go get help. He was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. We've talked about that a gazillion times. If anybody who's listens to the show knows, he had PTSD. He was diagnosed with a swath of other things. And he didn't go get any help. There's no proof or knowledge that we know that he was taking his meds or on his meds. We know he did not go to the counseling sessions he was supposed to go to. Not that, you know, a couple of them is going to do a whole lot for somebody with this severe of problems. But at the end of the day, he's living out of his truck. And the court is still saying, yeah, you should go have parental rights to go be with these three little girls. Again, it's just, what the hell is going on here? What the bar is so low to have to be able to be with your kids just because there's this romanticized idea that every parent just loves their kids unconditionally and la la la. No, they don't. Ultimately, the biggest safeguard that we have in this broken system, because of everything you just described, we don't have the staffing. We don't have the child welfare dollars that they need to do their job and to not get burned out and to be effective and solutions for these kids in these situations. So you got a judge that at the end of the day is kind of the last safeguard there that could have made a call saying, no, until you actually show that you followed through on these directives, you don't get to see your kids. But no, it's like, we need you to go do that. And in the meantime, you can keep seeing them. It's great. And there's no follow-up. There's no enforcing of anything. Yeah. And what you're left with is mom who's sitting here with this partner who is so damaged mentally. And They're showing up for visitation. They're showing up to take the kids. Her hands are tied. She calls the police. What would happen?
Yeah, very likely the police, if there is this court order, the police are obligated to allow what's in the court order to happen.
Yeah.
And the other horrible piece of this is for a parent to fight something like this and to say, you know what, he hasn't followed up with therapy. He hasn't done what he's supposed to do. She has to hire an attorney.
Yeah.
To go back into court. And God knows anybody who's been through divorce court, you're talking thousands and thousands of dollars, and often they want 10 grand up front before they'll even take a case like this. Mm-hmm. And that's simply not something that most people can do.
So we rely on the piece of paper. The piece of paper that doesn't get updated as the person's not doing what the piece of paper says they're supposed to be doing, and then that piece of paper is left for the officer out in the field that day who's working 30 other things to try and figure this out and go, well, the paper says it's and they're doing their job too, because there's people who just make things up as well. There's people who will use child custody as a way to try and incriminate the other parent, even if they're doing nothing wrong. So the officers have to figure out, well, which one is legit where they're not safe and which one is safe. Mm-hmm. So their hands are tied, but you had the judge who saw all of this stuff, who saw the evidence and still said, yep, you're safe. There's no repercussions for these bad choices of these judges. And I don't know what, should there be? Should there start to be something like that in place? I mean, I don't know how you would make that work of all the judges that make bad decisions, because eventually you're going to make some bad ones being a judge just by sheer numbers.
Sure feels like that would be the moral thing to do, is some kind of consequences when, you know, I think they would be a lot more careful if there were some kind of consequences for it.
But even beyond consequences, why don't we just have basic rules here? You need to have a place that you live other than a vehicle.
Yeah.
If you're going to have unsupervised visitation rights with your children, because chances are, if you don't have that, there's something wrong.
There's something very wrong.
Yeah.
But the horrifying thing is that people who are living in their cars have full custody of their children in many cases, or they're living under the bridge in a tent.
Yeah.
And you've got a whole community of families living like that with children in their custody. And this is just
horrendous. We allow it. I mean, why do we allow this? I mean, other than we have no other options, because that kind of feels like that is why we have a society where this is okay. And I mean, I know it's always existed to a certain extent, but to the extent we have it today and I know you see it where you are, you know, with the tent communities and such, where it's like, oh, this is like, and it's protected in a certain ways too. Like, it's a lifestyle choice. It's not a lifestyle choice. There's mental illness amongst like 99% of the folks out there. They need help.
Yeah.
They're not going to get it on their own by people dropping off food or money and then, hey, good luck back at the tent. That's not going to fix it.
Yeah.
Why do we do this? Why are we here?
It just goes back to, I think the system is confused. It's inefficient. And you do see, I think, in different communities, different levels of involvement. I know where I used to live in California, I had a practice largely centered on children for a while, and I would get lots of referrals from child welfare. And they would be these cases where, you know, one parent, the better parent, had been given custody, and the parent who had the problems had lost custody, was trying to reunify. And so I was the person, one of the people that they would send the child to and then do these sessions, including the parent, to see how is this parent doing. And there was one case in particular that the child had been horrendously neglected and abused and had done well, placed with his father. The mother was the one that had wounded him. And I saw that little boy for 5 years and wrote many letters to the court, which we are now discouraged from doing. It's considered, you know, unethical for us to stick our toes in and write letters to the court.
So the person who has like the most expertise in the actual situation, in the mental health, which is what is at question, we don't want to hear from you.
Yeah, yeah. So we were discouraged from doing that, but I was doing it at the time, and I consistently said, this parent is not making progress in treatment. They don't have the capacity to make progress in treatment. Again, it was the borderline cluster B diagnosis. And after about 5 years, and she spent gazillions of dollars on a very aggressive attorney. And after about 5 years, she got an unsupervised weekend a month with the child where she could take him to her home. And she had checked the boxes off with the parenting classes and, you know, other things. And the first weekend she had the child, she was driving drunk and plowed into the back of a semi-truck. And of course, the child was killed immediately in a horrifying way. And she was fine. She walked away from the accident. And I went to that funeral for that little boy. And I think that was about the time I said, I just can't do this work anymore. I couldn't do work with kids in those situations because I was haunted by that case. I dreamed of him for years. And it's a mess.
The rights seem to be there to protect the abusive parent. Mm-hmm. More than anything else.
It's more than the child.
More than the child, more than the parent that is being responsible and is giving healthy love and attention. It's protecting the abuser. And that's why do courts today, as you mentioned, why do they not want the opinion of the psychologist? That to me, because there's another voice involved, or the judge doesn't want to be questioned, because it's like, if you want to do this, you're the instruction manual, basically, on this kid. You're the one who knows them in an objective way more than a parent who can give objective opinion on this to a judge to make educated decisions. Why do they not want to hear your opinion?
I think this was a confusing one. There were certainly cases where you had clinicians who had biases and they were not appointed by the court. They were just working privately or with, you know, I got referrals from the Department of Social Services. And so the ethics boards over therapists, because there were problems with biases, and they came out and said, if you are not a court-appointed evaluator, meaning you have very special training and work within parameters and do psych testing, if you are not a court-appointed evaluator, you need to keep your nose out of it because you guys, meaning unregulated therapists out there, you're all over the place. So I think it was more the licensing boards that tried to crack down on it and just said, you know, if you're not a court-appointed evaluator, stay out of it. But I don't think we have enough court-appointed evaluators. I don't think they're often utilized adequately. And sometimes if there is one, they will talk to the treating therapist and include that information in their reports. So it can get in there.
It can,
but I don't think it's often enough.
There's not a good, healthy path for it to be there, as that should be a checkbox on its own. What does the evaluation say?
Yeah. Exactly.
That's the key part of all of this.
Yeah.
So this guy, Travis Decker, he gets online, starts searching for Canada relocation, how to get to Canada. And then he searched for methods of killing as well, plastic bags, zip ties, location choices, things of that nature. Then he gets the kids, and he's acting weird. And mom noted it, but it was his time. It was his time to go have time with the girls. And that's the last time she ever saw him. What the hell do you think's going through this guy's mind? I know that's a very insanely broad question, and we probably never know the answer to it, but he's planning on getting to Canada. He wants to get his girls, and clearly he's planning on killing them as well.
It's insidious. You know, there are a couple of things that we look for when parents murder their children. The first, of course, is psychosis. And we think of the case of Andrea Yates, who was schizophrenic, home alone with five kids, hallucinating about the devil, and had the delusion that the children were possessed and the only way that she could free them and send them to heaven with God was to drown them in the bathtub. And yeah, she killed all of them. So that's a very different case than something like this, where you look at, most often we would be looking at, was this about revenge? Was this about trying to cause pain to the children's mother because he was angry at her? His life was in the toilet. He was deteriorating. And how can we fathom someone who thinks that way? I mean, I think for you and I, it's just impossible to put yourself in the mind of a person like that. But yeah, you know, he was diagnosed borderline. I would guess that there was a lot of antisocial personality, meaning psychopathic traits mixed in there. Who knows how his military service affected him, diagnosed with PTSD. But there are millions and millions of people diagnosed with PTSD. It doesn't make them violent. It doesn't make them hurt their children. So it's a hard one to put together. But my guess is that there was this revenge element to it, which, of course, made him very dangerous and inappropriate for ever spending time with them.
Is this an example of a family annihilator?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Also called filicide.
Yeah. Because we, I mean, we've talked about that. Alec Murdaugh is one that they brought that up in. And basically, it kind of comes down to no shit's given. The world, like everything in my world is gone and going to be destroyed. So I might as well take everyone else out with me.
Yeah. And you throw in, as we always say with Cluster B, you get a mix of all these awful traits in the bad criminals. And the narcissism, the children belong to him. They're his. They're sort of like an extension of him. Mm-hmm. Therefore, he can do what he wants with them. And that's another warped perception.
The bodies were discovered on June 1st. They found his DNA there. It was very fast to when they found them. Authorities are now looking for him, as you know, out by you in the mountains in Washington. They assume he might be headed towards Canada. How do things like this, I mean, is there a typical way that something like this ends? And my gut is going to tell me that they're going to find him dead somewhere.
Yeah.
But I don't know if they're going to find him dead from suicide or they're going to find him dead from just, you know, living in the mountains and something accidentally happening. I don't know. Do people like this just tend to end it for themselves? Very often.
Yeah, very often they do. They may have a fantasy at first that they're going to survive this somehow, but then once it's done and reality hits, you're not going to get out of this. They will suicide or try to do the, you know, suicide by cop in some way. And that would be my first guess about how it ends.
And that's interesting because I don't know. I mean, again, you're not dealing with common sense here. I was going to say common sense would say, no, common sense doesn't matter in this equation.
It's an entirely different world. I did, I was not directly involved. I was asked to be involved and I declined. A woman also in the Pacific Northwest, interestingly, so I can say this, she was not my client, but I was contacted by somebody about trying to evaluate her in, you know, to help her.
Yeah.
And I said, that's one I can't validate that. But she had had a very brutal, bad divorce with her husband, was very angry at him, borderline personality, and had a newborn baby and left and actually went to a women's shelter and smothered the baby. And then tried to overdose herself, and she did not die. And of course, the baby did. And so she was charged with, I don't remember what the specific charge was, but they wanted a psychological excuse to, you know, get her out of the criminal thing. Mm-hmm. And in that case, I think there was possibly major depression with some psychotic features. And it was this sense of, well, I can't go on anymore, so I'm going to take the baby with me and we'll be together in the afterlife. And so you can get this kind of strange delusional thinking going that's maybe not fully psychotic, but it's not grounded in reality. So you can see people with very strange ways of perceiving the world.
I'm going to go, and I'm too selfish to be without you. So I love you so much, I'm going to take you with me.
Take you with me, yeah.
Yep. And that's the best place for you. Better than being with mom over here on this earth who's treating you well. And it's also, you know, it's got to be some sort of a dark F you to mom as well. Of
very true.
You have your stuff together, I don't. And screw you for that.
Yeah, it speaks of rage. Yeah. It really, really speaks of rage.
How the hell do we get ahead of these sort of people? Because they seem to be everywhere. I mean, I don't know. I struggle with this one because it remember like back in the 80s and 90s, you'd hear about these stories about the Susan Smiths of the world and that sort of stuff. And it would be like, oh, that'd be one of the big stories of the year. I remember in my yearbook in school, you'd get like the end of the year. Here's like what happened in pop culture, or the news and all that. And I remember like Susan Smith being in one of those of like, and this horrible mother did like, oh my God, yes. Now it's like every other week or maybe every week. And there's stories worse, far worse than even what she did. And it's happening all the time. Are we in that more of an unstable society than we were 20 years ago? Or are we hearing about these things more because they're being reported more and people are getting away with it less? And it's being brought to light. And there maybe was a lot more going on back then, but it was easier to slide under the radar back then with less technology to monitor.
That would be a really interesting one for me to research and try to get into the Justice Department data and see what are the statistics about filicide and is this happening more often? It sure seems like it is, but we also have the internet, which is giving us much more news. Mm-hmm. And, you know, murder suicides happen, it seems like happen more often. But we do live in an increasingly violent society with a lot of people who are homeless, a lot of people who are on drugs and altering their reality in ways that, you know, hurt their families. So I'm going to look that up. I don't know what the data would show, but that's a really good question.
It does make you wonder.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this is a world that you live in, and you, I'm sure you think about this stuff, and there is no easy answer, there is no easy solution to any of this. But, you know, from your experience, your expertise, if you were to try and get ahead of this sort of situation before the parent that has the problem gets the, you know, uninterrupted access, the unmonitored access with the kids, what would be some easy things? First, I want to talk about what we could put in place if, you know, the right people were doing it, like politicians and such that would need to be there. But then I also want to talk about what a mother can do with what exists or a father can do with what exists in place. So let's start with in a perfect world, Siobhan, and Siobhan can lead the way. And here's what we're doing, kids. With a big scepter. You need a scepter, I think, too.
That
glows. And it's like, the scepter says, and then you can tell everyone what to do. What would you do? How would we fix this?
This is so hard, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How to be succinct with that. Number one, fund child welfare agencies and make sure they have small caseloads that they follow up, that they monitor. If there's ever a problem reported, they get out there. And I do think that they're well-meaning people, but we're not giving them the resources they need. So we need to do that. We need, as you say, the politicians to get involved and to reevaluate all the biases that exist in the laws now toward family reunification. We need to change that. But then we need places where these kids can be loved and nurtured and taken care of. So how can we incentivize people to do foster care? Mm-hmm. And that's one that would take probably a creative team to come up with. But we need to, you know, do you give tax credits to people who can take on a couple of extra foster kids? I know for many people, it's perhaps a way of making extra money. And that's you know, not, you don't want people doing it just for the money. But on the other hand, it is expensive. And so that would be one area to look at. Can we, and then of course, once you determine that people are qualified to be foster parents, have social workers that go out regularly and monitor and do home visits, do unannounced home visits, and come in and make sure that those kids are being taken care of. So we need a better social safety net. There are organizations online, and I wish I had the names handy, of support groups where parents who are caught in this dilemma can meet online and give advice to each other and to try to come up with how do we present in court if you have to represent yourself pro per because you can't afford an attorney, how to do that. There's a woman, I know the name of the woman who started a big organization is Tina Swithin, W-I-T-H-I-N. And so Googling Tina Swithin would bring up her organization, but I forget the name of the organization, but that's what they do. It's a grassroots run by mothers who have been in this scenario, and in some cases, they have had people involved in their organization who did have the children murdered. And, you know, so there's just a wealth of knowledge and resources out there. But there's a lot of homework to do. And this idea that somebody who's homeless, who's mentally ill, who's unstable, is given any unsupervised time with children, we've got to take it seriously.
It seems like such an obvious thing, but one of those where nobody wants to basically upset something. Nobody wants to upset basically the system, quote unquote.
Right.
The only one you're going to really upset is the unstable parent. That and maybe the kids, if they don't quite grasp why this is not going on. I would say the kids may be a little bit more understanding, you know, if they're of a certain age. They can tell if something's wrong with mom or dad. You're going to upset that unstable person to begin with, which can then be dangerous, you know, if that person is just free and out there. So obviously there's a gazillion things that need to be worked on in our system. It's funny, we never hear that as like a campaign promise of I'm going to work to fund the child welfare system better. Mm-hmm. It's always the bathroom needs should change, or just things that are like not a huge issue, like
The parental rights movement is probably more vocal. Mm-hmm. The people who say child welfare service are Nazis and they want to eliminate them, that's probably a more vocal camp politically. And of course, I'm on the other side of that.
The kids need rights because there's not enough sane adults. They need people that are out there fighting for these kids' rights. And the fact, I'm just always baffled. And I know you see it far greater than I do, but these cases just enrage me as a parent.
It's horrifying.
It's like, what can we do? Like, the system surely can be fixed, but nobody has a way to do it. Another thing I would guess maybe would be a little more sensible is for more mental health training, and this would benefit so many ways, for the first responders, the officers who are showing up at someone's house when the defunct parent comes over and tries to get custody. But maybe they have the right to, but mom or dad is sitting there going, there's something really off about this person. Mm-hmm. There's something not right, where the officer can get in there and use their judgment, their actual judgment, not just, well, this court-ordered piece of paper that this person seems to say that was filed 5 months ago and really doesn't pertain to this person's current mental health status. We're going to go off of this versus everything you're saying.
Right, right. That would be good. And the other thing that would be absolutely fabulous is to have social workers go out with cops in cases like this, just as we're seeing a movement, and there's not enough, but this was also a job I did. The therapist or social worker that goes out when there is somebody violent and hallucinating and they're not sure, is it mental illness? Is it, you know, other kinds of criminal behavior? And the clinician can then make a judgment. No, this person needs to go to the psych ward. That's what's happening here, and can try to de-escalate the situation. For any cases like this, that would also be a great time to have a therapist along. Because we do expect a lot of cops, and frankly, they're not all insightful people. They don't all have the personality to do a good assessment. But that, again, is something that would take money. But I think that would be well worth it.
all these things it would be lovely to have happen, but that's not the world we are living in currently. So let's say your dad, let's say your mom, the former partner shows up erratic, saying some weird things, but it's their time. It's their time to be with the kids. They're not expressly stating they're going to hurt them or anything, but they're just, they're off. And you know they're off because you've been with that person for a while. What do you do? Do you just follow the rule and say, because I know that one of the big things is when it's their time to have the kids, you can't stop them from doing that.
Right.
I think that maybe should be laid off a little bit. I really do. Because I know it can work the other way, but it can certainly work this way too, where mm-hmm. you got to use your judgment and maybe mm-hmm. just lock the door, shut mm-hmm. it. They're not coming in.
Take those kids and flee. Yeah.
And do what you need. Because at the end of the day, if you feel that way, obviously you're going to have to get to court. You're going to have to argue it. But I would think a judge would be a lot more sympathetic to mom or dad or whoever it is, saying, here's why I didn't let that happen. It's not because I don't want them to be a parent. I would love it if they could be. But here's why they've demonstrated the 52 ways that you already know about, why they can't be and why they're not. And I would hope the court would go in their favor and say, okay, you used a good judgment call. Unfortunately, that's probably not what happens a lot of the time. And that's why mm-hmm. and we end up going, well, you got to do what the court says. And mm-hmm. then you put people in danger and they end up like this.
Yeah. And document everything. So if and when you go before a judge, you have got a record. And, you know, because the judges, if they don't see the evidence, they don't necessarily believe people because people do come into court and lie sometimes. But if you have documentation, phone recordings, mm-hmm. text messages, save all that stuff.
We all got one of these. And I say, I don't care what your recording laws are in your state, hit record. Every interaction you have, put it in your pocket. Make sure that you're getting anything and everything you need because you may need it. And even in times when you don't think you're going to need it, have it ready. Have it ready on a day that you think it's going to be peaceful and wonderful because you never know. And then when you need that to justify if you have to stand up for your kids and say you're not taking them, you have that. That is so important that, you know, we didn't have that in the past. Use more of your own judgment. Would you say that even if you know you're doing the court didn't say, but if you feel your kids' lives are at risk, don't chance it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't chance it. God. Well, he's still out there. We'll see if they find him, at least as of this recording. He's out there. And a system that's very broken and will continue to be broken until we actually do anything. Do you think we'll ever see any movement on this? What is it going to take to motivate people to get behind, I don't know, standing up for children who are being abused
I
by
tell
horrible.
You,
like,
I,
it just seems to be like the easy low-hanging fruit, but it doesn't seem to, nobody's like grasping at it, but nobody gets into this the way that they should.
No. But you know, that just makes me think again of Sandy Hook and Uvalde and all the school shootings. Yeah. And it's like, can't we do something about that? Can't we do something about 16, 18-year-olds with AR-15s? I mean, that also seems like low-hanging fruit. Come on.
It does.
I mean, we've got to pull together and do something. We thought after Parkland that, you know, there was going to be, because a mentally ill kid went out on his 18th birthday and bought the AR-15, and he had a lengthy history of violence and bizarre behavior and had announced on YouTube, I will be the next school shooter. And nothing happened. The FBI, he slipped through the cracks. And you know, it wouldn't be that hard to tighten up some of this stuff. But we seem to sacrifice kids in this country, even though people think it's terrible when it happens. We can't seem to get organized to do better.
And that's the thing. I mean, it's not that people don't feel this way, but they don't feel this way. They don't go down and protest this way. You never see protests out there for things like this. You see protests out there for everything else.
Right.
But we're not going to protest this sort of thing. And politicians and the decision makers, they make choices and decisions when they feel there's a fire under their ass.
Wonderful point.
And there is no fire other than from people who have been victimized by this system, where they may eventually be held accountable. And there's no threat of being held accountable for your bad decisions. There's very likely not going to be many decisions made in that direction.
Yeah.
And that seems to be where we sit. Is it because it's too icky? Is it because it's one of those topics that if I would say a majority of us don't have, you know, a kid in our home that's going to go shoot up the school, a majority of us don't necessarily have someone in our life like this. And so the majority is the crowd, but because the majority is not directly affected by these things, they don't see just how dark and dangerous it is until they are directly affected?
100%. I think the denial is thick and people can read the story. They go, oh my God, that's terrible. And then they wipe it out of their consciousness. It's just like having mandated treatment for schizophrenic people living on the street, eating out of garbage cans who can't take care of themselves. But the law says they have the legal right as free Americans to eat out of garbage cans if they want to. Yeah. It's like we could do something about that too. But unless you have a person like that in your family, a brother, you know, a sister, a child who's in that condition, then people get involved. But that's not the majority of people. Yeah. So we don't see any shift with that.
It's scary because the sad part is it's like this has to get, I mean, it already feels like it's an epidemic proportions, but it's like it just has to get far worse before you'd actually see people moving towards a solution. And I feel like right now where we sit, it almost feels too late, the way that our society is functioning and what we've bred over the last however many years. And it just seems so out of control. I don't know that we're ever going to get there. I mean, I don't know the answer to this. Do other countries have the same issues with their child welfare systems as we do? I mean, is it worse? Is it better? Do you know the answer to that question? I don't know the answer.
I do know they don't have the violence to the same extent we do, although there was a mass shooting in Austria, I'm told yesterday, in a school. So I think we're training the rest of the world on this stuff. We're influencing them in the wrong direction. But I try to hold hope, but I tell you, I have to do a lot of talking to myself about how to stay mentally balanced and focus on the good things in life. So I don't go into a deep pit of depression over all of it, which is very easy to do.
Yeah, here I am.
And do our best to role model, as you're doing, what's the right way to be in the world, how to be healthy, how to have good relationships, how to love our kids, and keep talking about those things, trying to spread that. Because I do think emotions spread, and just like awful stuff on the internet spreads, so does positive stuff on the internet. And so we want to keep putting these messages out there. There are resources. People often don't know what they are. But yeah, Tina Swithin, Moms Something, I forget the name of the organization. And then the childwelfaremonitor.org are some ideas. But the more we can get people activated on a grassroots level, and as you say, raise awareness, put some noise out there. Get some politicians willing to look at this and say, what can we do legislatively? And how can we incentivize people to become foster parents? You know, good people who really care about kids. I guess I need to look at myself, you know? I'm a little tired. I raised a bunch of kids. And
I think you've done your part, Siobhan.
But I do think it's the highest calling. It's a wonderful path for someone who can do it.
It is. And it's a very interesting system, the way that it works. My girlfriend actually just fostered a child for a little while temporarily, who was in a bad home until he could get with some of his sister or family members. And she went through the process and, you know, very responsible adult and you know, just a great loving home and mother. But was also kind of put back by like the amount, you hear the stories so much of like the kids that are in really rough situations and like not being checked on very much. She's like, the amount that they check on me, it's kind of interesting because like they see it's like a lovely home, but like, I just wonder about all these homes over here that are like really in bad shape that these kids are just, you know, running amok and free. But like, why don't they push some of that energy over here rather than show up in my place as much as they do?
Yeah.
Like, I get it's probably easier to find you and check the boxes, which at the end of the day they need to do. And those ones might be harder to get to, but it's a system where, once you're in it and once you are a good person who's in it for the right reasons, you want to walk away from that going, I want to keep doing this because it works well, it's efficient, and it's not an insane burden to me and the rest of my family to do this. Not that the child is, but the system itself. And that the system itself seems to have a lot of issues, even in that area. It's so broken, it's so flawed, and we're just like, well, this is how it works.
Right. So we keep talking about it. We keep raising awareness, and that's something you and I can do.
And we keep seeing dead kids all the time. But yes, that's why we keep talking about it.
Right.
And people out there can talk about it too. Understanding is the thing that makes people motivated. So taking it in, understanding it, and then getting out there and going, even if I don't have someone in my life who's done this to me or I've experienced, I can understand from someone else's grief, someone else's suffering, someone else's torture, how important this is, and say something when it's going on and make a ruckus about it. And just don't let the broken people in our world dictate the rules, because that seems to be what's happening.
Yeah, very true.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible. Financial geniuses. Monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it. So your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible. Financial geniuses. Monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it. So your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice, and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paul Azan, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible. Financial geniuses. Monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it. So your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.